much to the committee for their kind invitation to give this talk today. It's indeed an honour to do so. In this lecture, I'd like to cover the contribution of epidemiology to infection prevention and control by addressing some learning from the past, what we know in the present, and where the future might go and how the role of epidemiology might continue to contribute to infection prevention and control. So the past. Well, like all good epidemiologists, I need to start with a definition, and I'm sure you're all aware that epidemiology is the study of disease in human populations. But sometimes in our day-to-day working, we forget how much of a contribution it's really made to saving lives in terms of global health and worldwide. Millions of people have been saved through epidemiology discovering risk factors for infection. And epidemiology has really prompted advances in medical science and better ways of controlling and preventing disease, not just for infection, but also for cancers, heart disease, and all the traditional public health problems. So people describe epidemiology as the stethoscope, thermometer, and sphinx of global health, because you need it to measure outcomes and you need it to actually define what the goals are from a public health perspective. But I think an epidemiologist is best described through the vehicle of a tin of sardines. And I know you're looking at that thinking, why is there a tin of sardines on the slide? Well, a professor of epidemiology who taught me years ago told a story that I'd like to share with you today about an experiment that was done to try and define what epidemiology is. And the experiment was carried out with three participants, a surgeon, a pathologist, and an epidemiologist. And it was carried out in an operating theatre, an unusual place for some of those people to be, but it was an operating table, and on the operating table was a tin of sardines. So the surgeon was asked to go in and write a report of what he found. So he went into the operating table, stayed there for around 2 minutes, came back out with a report that said, can of sardines. And when the researcher went back into the operating theatre, they found a very neatly opened can of sardines, nothing spilled anywhere, and absolutely immaculate theatre. So the pathologist was invited in, and the pathologist was in for about 20 minutes, came out with a two-page report. The two-page report said, you know, there was an operating table, there was a round can on it. In the round can, there were 6 sardines. I opened the can according to the procedure of such and such. All the sardines were the same size. And when it came out of the operating theatre, it was covered in sunflower oil. And the researcher noted when they went back into the operating theatre that there were sardines everywhere, the guts were spilled all over the table. So the epidemiologist went in last of all. And the epidemiologist was in there for about 8 hours, and the researcher was getting quite worried. Eventually, the epidemiologist emerged with a 20-page report. And the researcher noted that the can of sardines on the operating table was intact and hadn't been opened. And the report detailed how to estimate the number of sardines in that can. And that best describes what epidemiology does, I think. So the first nurse epidemiologist, of course, was Florence Nightingale, and you can hardly do a talk on infection prevention and control and mention epidemiology without mentioning her. And, of course, you'll remember the story of the Crimean War and the fact that she went to the hospital, the conditions were appalling. The mortality rate was 42% when she arrived. And through infection prevention and control, but more importantly in the context of this lecture, using data for intelligence and turning that intelligence into action, she reduced the mortality rate in the hospital to 2% within 2 months. And this was a phenomenal achievement at that time. But the history of the contribution of epidemiology to infection prevention and control goes back beyond that time. And the sort of first real contribution to infection prevention and control was around the 18th century. And remarkable amongst those pioneers was Sir John Pringle, who was a physician from Scotland, which is why I'm making special mention of him today. But he was one of the first people to notice in the hospitals that overcrowding and poor ventilation appeared to have an association with infection. So proper hospital epidemiology was really done there. 100 years later was Florence in the Crimean War, and really the first nurse epidemiologist using data for action in that respect. But our real understanding and contribution of epidemiology to infection prevention and control came about in the bacteriological era with Koch and Lister and others. It really moved the agenda on, you know, leaps and bounds at that point. So much so that towards the end of the 19th century, it was considered that the war was won. And as Mark is saying, you need to be clear that sometimes you think the war is won when it really isn't at all. It's just a battle within the war that's been won. So, with the opening of infectious disease hospitals in the early 20th century, it was very clear that the battle had been won for one type of organism, but not necessarily for all. And infectious disease hospitals really demonstrated beautifully how infection transmits across all specialties, that problems that historically were thought to happen just in surgery happened everywhere in the hospital. And actually, there was a gathering momentum around trying to prevent and manage these infections. But our real understanding of infection prevention and control happened really in the 1960s onwards. And some seminal work in the 1960s by epidemiologists in the US noted that when you fed back information to clinicians on staphylococcal epidemics, that there's something happened intentionally or unintentionally with behaviour that resulted in a reduction in infection rates. And that seminal work really led to the development of what I would call the mothership of infection control, which is the Senex study.
And Robert Haley and colleagues designed the study to look at what elements in infection prevention and control really define effectiveness and efficacy. And this was a large-scale epidemiology study that's the theoretical framework and underpinning of infection control as we know it today. And Halley had said that there were four main elements that were required: intensive surveillance, intensive control, a programme of regular feedback to clinicians, and engaged physicians. And hospitals that had all of those elements, as we know, could reduce infection by around 30% over 5 years. Now, we had the great fortune to have the great Robert Haley at conference last year. And he said the same message that he was saying from the Senex study in his presentation. So he said, we really must use epidemiology, we must measure and feedback infection rates of all HAI problems that need to be reduced. So the message is the same today. So where are we today? Well, epidemiology that has been done over the last 20 years has informed us that we have a significant burden of healthcare-associated infection. European Union data indicate that there are over 4 million patients in the EU every year with a healthcare-associated infection. And there's significant mortality and morbidity associated with these infections. And the estimated number of deaths in the EU is close on 40,000 a year. So this is a big public health problem. And just to put it into context, other traditional public health problems such as cancers and heart disease, when you look at the numbers for those, they do not look as important as healthcare-associated infection. So, as a case in point, there were 300,000 cases of colorectal cancer in the EU, 85,000 cases of TB, 4 million healthcare-associated infections. And that's even with the reductions that we've begun to see. So the European Centre for Disease Control helpfully produced this league table of prevalence surveys across industrialised countries just in the last couple of years. And they've presented it a couple of times in their annual report. And the reason that they're publishing this is to demonstrate the variation in prevalence that you find across these countries. So, you know, Germany has a prevalence of 3.5%, must be doing something right. Scotland features towards the higher end of prevalence, 9.5%. But if you look at these data, there's real variation. And aggregated international data like that, the reasons for the variation can be multiple, but include various definitions and methods that have been used to do the studies, intrinsic risk factors in the patient population in terms of case mix being different across different countries. Some countries have much older patient populations than others. And extrinsic risk factors in the way that healthcare is delivered and the practices and processes of health are delivered therein. But what these data presented in this research does demonstrate is that there's variation that can be addressed. And internationally, that needs to happen. And ECDC have a 5-year strategic plan focused on antimicrobial resistance and healthcare-associated infection, with a real focus of epidemiology at the heart of trying to understand that better. When you drop down a level from these international kind of aggregated data sets and you look at national-level data, you begin to be able to make the link between epidemiology and policy. Now, in Scotland, we had the great fortune to be funded to do a gold standard prevalence survey in 2006, and when we published these data in 2007, it said that 1 in 10 in acute care at any one time had an infection, but because the study was really large and had been done by independent data collectors and it had a really large data set, we had lots of intelligence around healthcare-associated infection that had never, ever been known in Scotland before. And so it told us that our infections were predominantly gastrointestinal, told us that actually a lot of those were Clostridium difficile, it told us that surgical site infection was still important, and that urinary tract infection was important. It also helped us understand that there were particular specialties where there was a bigger burden of infection than others, and these were care of the elderly, medicine and surgery. And what was fantastic about this epidemiology was that the Scottish Government took that report and took every recommendation out of it and built a policy delivery plan for the next 3 years based on that. And so the focus of all the work at a country level going forward was on the intelligence from that epidemiology, which is remarkable because that had never been done before. So it can inform national policy. Part of what we collected at that time was the additional length of stay attributable to infection, and we found that patients with an infection stayed in hospital 70% longer than those that didn't. And because normal length of stay varies by specialty, that meant an awful lot of time for people in care of the elderly as opposed to obstetrics. But nonetheless, this additional burden of infection can have a price put on it. And of course, by default, you can make the business case for infection control. So for Scotland, we were able to say these infections only in acute care in any 1 year cost £200 million a year. And those types of amounts of money really have an impact at policy level. And of course, we have intelligence from other studies across other countries that tell us that, you know, there's billions and billions of pounds involved in healthcare-associated infection. And that's great. But the key question in making the business case is how much of that is preventable now? So can we really say what the irreducible minimum of HAI is? It's not known. We do know for some types of infections that we believe zero may be achievable, and maybe those are device-related infections. But how will we know we're there if we don't know what it is? And we do need epidemiology to continue to inform all of that as time goes on. But there's an ongoing battle because new technologies will emerge, new interventions in healthcare will come along, each with their own infection risks, which may mean in some cases that we actually reduce infection, but in other cases that we actually have more risk for infection. On top of that, we need to better understand some of the existing practice that we have. Absence of evidence isn't absence of effect. Nonetheless, there are some practices that we do that have negative outcomes, not necessarily infection-related negative outcomes, but they do need to be questioned. Now, one of these particular practices of interest to me is the practice of cohorting. Now, cohorting is an interesting practice. The evidence base for it is at best sketchy. And the evidence base that does exist is for nurse cohorting. And nurse cohorting is dedicated nursing staff for a cohort of patients. In reality, from a study that I've been involved in just recently, the practice is patient cohorting that happens. So it's separation of patients in one area, but it's the same nursing staff looking after those patients that are looking after the rest of the ward. There's no evidence base for that whatsoever. And unfortunately, one of the negative consequences of that practice is that it results in bed blocking and really real big problems with bed management, particularly when you're trying to manage single-sex policy as well as bed management for infection risk aspects. There's a really nice piece of epidemiology done by Jorge Capida and colleagues, which looks at a prospective study in intensive care with a crossover design, really robust epidemiology, and looked at whether cohorting as an intervention actually reduced transmission of MRSA in intensive care. It's a small study, it's in one unit, but nonetheless really well designed, and it demonstrated that cohorting had no added benefit. So we do need to begin to question some of the things that we do, because we would be insane if we didn't. And in fact, with emerging issues that we'll have in healthcare that I'm going to come to, we will need to really begin to challenge some of these practices. In healthcare-associated infection, we have got a global public health threat. And we, unfortunately, across the healthcare collective, don't do things in a way, in a system that really reduces risk. We've actually got a system that's set up to cause 1 in 10 patients having an infection. And so we put people into acute care, we move them round the hospital, we move them in and out of isolation depending on competing demands and the fact that we don't have enough isolation facilities. We move them to other hospitals. Some people move back to care homes or longer term care. People coming from care homes only represent 2% of the acute hospital inpatient population, but have a 1 in 4 chance of being colonised with MRSA. And when we put them into hospital, we move them round the hospital to other hospitals. And actually, that patient population are also more likely to be readmitted. And a third of the acute patient population is readmitted. Readmissions, a third of them. So you can see there that we've got a system that is really nicely set up to disseminate colonisation and infection across the whole healthcare collective. Added complications with globalisation of healthcare are such that we've got people going abroad to have operations now, and then when things go wrong, they come back and are admitted to our hospitals. And so we have emerging threats such as NDM1 and others that are brought about as a result of the globalisation of healthcare. So I think continuing to have an acute care focus on infection prevention and control is no longer possible. And there needs to be a move to look at epidemiology in particular, because most of our intelligence on infection is acute care focused. We need epidemiology and an understanding of it across the whole healthcare collective. And this will be important in terms of the advances in surgery, because even those infections that we count in acute care actually don't tell us a true picture of the epidemiology as it is in acute care. So we have hospitalised patients who are older, we have a length of stay that's reducing, and we have advances in surgery in particular that mean that many of the infections that we should find in acute care actually don't happen there. They happen outside acute care. And as a case in point, if you look at all the surgical site infection data that's produced by most of the European countries now, and you look at the infection incidence over time for inpatient rates, what you'll find is that nearly every country in Europe is seeing a reducing incidence in inpatient rates. But nearly every country is also seeing a reduction in length of stay over the same time. So what we have here in reality is artefacts. So we're patting ourselves on the back saying that this is reducing, when in actual fact all that's really happening is length of stay is reducing. So we're counting fewer infections. And actually, the infections that are happening outside of hospital, and it may not be going down at all. Some work that we've been doing in Scotland, beginning to look at new ways of capturing these data, because we will need to get clever about it, has demonstrated that if we look at surgery as a case in point, there is no one size that fits all, and it's really challenging trying to follow patients up. And because it's difficult, it's not done particularly well, and there's no consistency in the way that people do things. So, for example, where you have very short length of stay, like breast surgery and caesarean section, where the length of stay is about 3 days on average, the proportion of infections happening after discharge is much higher. So for caesarean section here, the yellow block in the bar chart is those infections that have happened after discharge. So it's close on 80% for caesarean section. Whereas for hips and knee replacement, it's a much smaller proportion because the length of stay is closer to a week. So some work that we've done here has indicated that you can target different epidemiological methods to your follow-up to different types of category of surgery. So for hip and knee replacement, if you do readmission surveillance only, you'll get about 80% of all your infections. And that's relatively easy to do. For caesarean section, you absolutely need to do something after discharge to catch these because they won't come back into hospital. And in Scotland, we're one of the only countries in Europe who have actually made it mandatory to follow up to 10 days post-op. using community midwives as a model. But in many countries, that's not possible because they no longer see patients in the pathway post-op. So we need to get clever about thinking how we might gather some of this intelligence. And I've been very lucky to be involved in some studies looking at telephone surveillance. And you may well laugh, but we actually did this. We did automated telephony, which is a term I didn't know, where we have a waiting time centre in Scotland. It's a hospital that's for waiting list initiatives, so it does surgery on patients from all over Scotland. People from remote and rural islands, the Western Isles, come down to this centre in Glasgow, have their operation, and then are discharged back home. So trying to follow those patients up is a real challenge. So they had a piece of software that they were using, automated telephony software, instead of outpatient clinics. And it was actually used for long-term condition follow-up, like, you know, arthritis and so forth. But we decided that we would try and develop it for post-discharge surveillance. And it really was press one if you've got pus. And everyone laughed as you're laughing. And we thought, this will never work, but it's worth the go. And we got these patients who were having orthopaedic implant surgery, and they were predominantly an older patient population. We thought maybe the compliance won't be good and so forth. But they loved it. They loved that there was somebody, well, a phone person, it's not really a person, that they could phone. But the information, the equipment is so sophisticated. What it did was you pressed one if you've got pus and all the different criteria, and it sent an email alert to the infection control team, so that they were only following up those that really needed to be followed up. And when you have an infection incidence that's relatively low, like 2%, 3%, you know, it's much better if you're only following up those 2 and 3 rather than the other, you know, 98 patients that don't have infection. So it was a really good way of following up. And that particular centre used that system to this day. Now, the only downside to it is that the actual piece of kit, the capital investment of it is huge. So unless you've got it there, it's probably not going to be cost effective. But it demonstrates innovation in the way that we think and moving with technologies that are there and really harnessing them so that we can better understand the epidemiology of infection. And this is so important because in order to identify risk factors, you really need to have the burden of infection. Only when you have the intrinsic risks in the patient population and the extrinsic risks in terms of the patient care practices can we produce guidance for prevention and management of those infections. And when we produce the guidance, it allows us to identify the gaps that research needs to address. But if you don't have that full picture, you cannot produce guidance that's really robust. And as a case in point, I was involved in a piece of work in an obstetrics hospital in Scotland looking at caesarean section infection, and the intrinsic and extrinsic risks in the inpatient population in terms of infection compared to the whole population when we did post-discharge surveillance were different. And without that post-discharge surveillance intelligence, we wouldn't have understood what it was we needed to do to try and reduce the risk. So that's how epidemiology can be used nationally. We've talked about internationally, and it can also be used locally to improve care. So there are some really nice examples in the literature around using really robust epidemiological methods locally so that you can reduce risk. This is a study by colleagues in Germany who had problems with surgical infection and, like most people, implemented a bundle of interdisciplinary multiple modal interventions, you know, 7 or 8 of them all at the one time. And in fact, this is one of the problems with much of the infection control literature. The Centre for Disease Control just issued AMR guidance around infection prevention and control measures, and they noted that the real problem with the literature underpinning this is that everyone has done multiple interventions and not worked out which bits of that actually have an impact on outcome. But this is a good example of a study who actually took it a step further than just saying, we implemented all these interventions and this was the outcome. They actually did a really well-designed case control study, which is a fundamental underpinning of epidemiology, and through multivariate analysis actually identified which of the risk factors actually made a difference. And so they found the independent risk factors for infection were age and diabetes and blood glucose intra-op. But they also found the protective factors were if they had preoperative antibiotic prophylaxis and extubation in the day of surgery. So they were able to actually tease out which interventions happened to make the infection reduce. But we also need new approaches for newish issues. Now, MRSA, we've seen significant reductions in MRSA bacteremia across the UK. But interestingly, we're still red on the European Centre for Disease Control map. This map, which ECDC produce each year, demonstrates by country the proportion of Staph aureus isolates which are MRSA. And if you're red or purple, it's not good. It means you have high endemic proportions. Now, the UK has been red on this map for several years. And interestingly, when you look at the distribution of the colours, you could argue that we should probably be green along with the Scandinavian countries, or at least amber with Central Europe, because the other countries that are red are all Southern Europe. But interestingly, of course, MRSA has been endemic in the UK for many years now, but the question about universal screening for MRSA has only recently been asked by politicians. Some might argue 20 years too late, but nonetheless, it's been asked. And we've been involved in some epidemiology trying to look at, you know, the real-world observation of universal screening as it is in healthcare delivery just now. And some of the evidence around MRSA screening, we must remember, particularly with reference to the interventions associated with it, comes from studies that were done years ago when people's lengths of stay in hospital were really long. And we've got a healthcare delivery system now in acute care where the average length of stay is 3 days. Now, bear that 3 days in mind while I talk you through some of the issues that we've come across with MRSA screening. So the technologies that we have for testing, currently the most cost-effective and clinically effective test is chromogenic agar. Now, there are other emerging technologies, PCR and near-patient testing, but the sense and spec of those tests isn't as good as chromogenic agar, and the costs at the moment are probably prohibitive, especially for universal screening. But the turnaround time for chromogenic agar as a test is 2 days for a positive. So we've got that. We've got interventions, which is isolation and decolonisation or suppression therapy. Those interventions, the suppression therapy, take 5 days. So we've got 2 day turnaround, 5 days of interventions, but the patient's only in hospital for 3 days. So how do you make that happen in an effective way so that the screening and the associated interventions actually serve to reduce risk during the period of risk? So we need to think quite innovatively about how we make screening and associated interventions work in the way that healthcare is delivered now, in order to make sure that we get our best bang for our buck. So, to the future. I'm no mystic, Meg, but there are some known knowns that we need to deal with and some known unknowns. Now, the story of King Canute, if you don't know it, he was a king who believed that he could stand at the edge of the sea and command the tide to stop. He wasn't very successful. Had to hang his crown on his throne at the edge of the sea and retire. But actually, this is a good analogy for antimicrobial resistance. We cannot stop the tide of evolution. But if we're clever in the way that we use epidemiology, we can certainly enhance our understanding so that we can at least minimise the damage. Now, this was my background for my first slide, and it wasn't just some random picture. It's actually really sophisticated visualisation techniques for epidemiology that are used now. And the red lines are positive correlations between diseases, and the blue lines are negative ones. And the thickness of the line tells you the strength of the association, and the size of the balls tell you how many people have that particular disease. Now, it's really fancy cutting-edge epidemiology, and it's used to describe, in this scenario, 1.5 million people and what the relative risk of having one disease is compared to another. And maybe this needs to be the direction that we go in understanding some of these emerging antimicrobial resistant mechanisms. So where will epidemiology go in the 21st century and beyond? So it's a rapidly changing discipline, and it needs to be in order to try and take account particularly of the AMR agenda. And molecular epidemiology is absolutely needed so that we can refine the measurement techniques and truly understand what we're dealing with. We've got biomarkers of disease now. We've got genetic epidemiology now, the post-genome mapping era results in sophisticated technologies that we can use to really understand association between risk factors. We have fancy statistical models now, which allow us to look at all the interventions that we're doing in the context of outcome. And we need to make sure that all of that, which historically laboratory-based, actually comes into practice through the mechanism of using applied epidemiology. And this is beginning to happen. This study from colleagues in Birmingham just recently is a really nice demonstration of using fine-grained typing to actually truly begin to understand transmission of infection. And it was a multi-drug-resistant organism in a hospital setting with shared care, and they had military casualties and civilians involved. And in that outbreak, the current standard techniques meant that the different types of strain that they had were indistinguishable. And they were able to use whole genome sequencing to identify in a way that allowed discrimination between alternative epidemiological hypotheses in that setting. And this needs to be the direction of how we harness all that emerging technology using our epidemiology skills, even in a local setting with one outbreak, never mind with the big aggregated data sets that I've already demonstrated to you. But I have a word of warning. Epidemiology has been a bit of a hostage to hyping health risks over the last few years. And we need to make sure that studies are very well described in a way that the limitations are acknowledged. And also, when we have alternative studies with alternative findings on one topic, and MRSA screening is a case in point, there's continuing emerging literature, some for, some against, still no consensus, and that can be used against the science in many ways in the way that it's reported. So we have a responsibility to try and make sure we have an informed media and informed politics to make sure that the resources are in the right place. And a Harvard professor of epidemiology described this best when he said, epidemiology and democracy actually have a thing in common. They both have many problems and weaknesses, but they still represent the best available approach for achievement of their respective objectives. But a word of warning. Some of the literature that we have in infection prevention and control, particularly the epidemiological stuff, is dangerous, and it results in bad and ineffective and inappropriate infection prevention and control measures. Deming, who's a really eminent statistician, said, when you've got two data points, it's really likely that one will be different from the other. And much of the literature is really limited by people measuring before and after. And so we need to get better at the way that we use epidemiology methods, because I've not mentioned names of papers here, but you'll find them yourselves in the literature. If you change your definition for infection, you can count fewer events. And if you look at the published literature, ventilator-associated pneumonia varies from 20% to 80%, depending on the definition you use. If you don't count infections if someone's colonised on admission, you can change your outcome. And if you change from clinical surveillance to microbiologically based surveillance for most types of infection, you'll reduce by half. So this, my word of warning is we need to be really careful in the way we interpret definitions and the methods used, but also that we need to get clever in using time series analysis in particular, and using frameworks for reporting these studies such as Orion and also STROBE, so that we report things in a robust way. So how do we make that happen? Well, maintaining and developing the role of epidemiology is critical. We've got lots of new roles in epidemiology in infection prevention and control now. We've got clinical epidemiologists, there are surveillance coordinators, there are nurse epidemiologists, molecular epidemiologists. And for the first time last year, the European Centre for Disease Control published competencies for epidemiology, which is a great step forward in trying to ensure that we have a confident and competent workforce in this field. The Health Protection Agency have also been developing healthcare epidemiology competencies in recognition of the fact that this is a specialty in its own right now. And the thing that really differentiates healthcare epidemiologists from the broader ones is understanding healthcare systems itself. The IPS are going to launch competencies today, which is great to see for infection prevention and control. And underpinning some of those competencies is epidemiology, which I'm delighted to see. So if we are able to build this competency framework across the infection prevention and control community, we can then use that mechanism to have this confident and competent workforce, and it allows us to educate society, policymakers, the media and the public. So in summary, epidemiology has informed the development of infection prevention and control to date. And current epidemiology tells us there's still a significant burden and much work to do. There's an ongoing need for epidemiology in order that we might reach the irreducible minimum of HAI and know that we are there. And understanding and using epidemiology is critical to improvement and infection prevention and control locally, nationally and internationally. So my argument would be that epidemiology can be expected to play a major role in the future of infection prevention and control. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. Fabulous paper as ever. My chief exec of my organisation is in the audience this week, and he now knows I've been guessing for the last...